Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hi, everybody. This is Phil Town.
This is Danielle Town.
And we're here with the Invested Podcast, where we talk about stuff like Rule 1 investing.
And we talk about how to feel good about what you're doing with your money. How to come up with what to do with your money in the first place.
Is it really possible to buy $10 worth of value for only $5 the way Buffett says he does it?
Well, that's the $10 question.
That is the $10 question. That's you know, he obviously does it, right? I mean, you can't fault that. Although there are still people who are strong efficient market theorists who argue that you're always going to have these 3-4 sigma events, right? Where you're in a random marketplace or in a random game, like flipping coins, and or a roulette wheel or something like that, where there's known probabilities, and there's always going to be that coin flip that goes 100 heads in a row, which they would argue is the normal standard deviation is, you know, one sigma is like 67% probability, and then two sigmas is like 95, and then three sigmas is like 99% unlikely, and then four sigmas is 99.7% unlikely or whatever, and five sigma event is 99.99999 unlikely, and then six, you see what I'm saying? There are these potentially possible once in a billion years sigma events. And one guy recently said Warren Buffett is a Six Sigma event. He's one guy like that in a billion years in the universe.
So he's essentially a statistical, not quite anomaly, but statistical, I don't know.
I think anomaly is the right word. He's a statistical anomaly.
Well, it's not an anomaly, though, because it's predicted by the statistics someone like that will be able to do it.
It's predicted.
But it will be one.
Yeah.
And not
20. Not 20. And Buffett, as I think we remarked before, went to Columbia University in 1988 and made a list of something like 12 or 15 or 20 guys, all of whom were flipping heads 100 times in a row, you know, in terms of their stock market returns. And he said that, you know, maybe even that could be random in some random universe, you know, big enough set of possibilities going on out there. You got 26 sigma events happening all at once, but it wouldn't be random if they've all come from the same school. They're all doing it in the same zoo, in other words.
Right.
Then it's not random anymore. And so I think, you know, that became the beginning of the end of this paradigm, but it's continuing to persist because there's no other mathematics that anybody's developed that will tell you what your risk is for any given pile of investments other than the one developed by academics in modern portfolio theory. And Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger had to go over to Salomon Brothers a few years ago and kind of put their credibility online to keep the company open for a while it liquidated its assets. And they watched really smart guys who have really a ton of degrees from Wharton and Harvard continue to use a theory that says that risk and reward are intimately related. You can't get a higher risk without a higher reward. Sorry, you can't get a higher reward without a higher risk. And evaluate investments based on what Charlie was saying is a complete fabrication. He said, we've never seen so many smart people do so many dumb things, but thank goodness they keep doing it so we can keep making all this money. So we have such a vastly different point of view over here in Rule 1 investing that says that you can, in fact, buy $10 bills for $5, which means you can, in fact, get a high rate of return for a low risk, when the rest of the world, including virtually all financial advisors and the SEC, think that that's heresy. You can't do it. and that Warren Buffett, as this guy is saying, is a Six Sigma event. So
on that thing you said about it would not be such an anomaly if they all came from the same school.
Yeah.
I'm reading this really interesting book right now on risk management, and I haven't gotten all the way through it. I keep saying I've started books and haven't gotten all the way through it. Whatever, that's how I do it. So it's really interesting. They're talking about the difference between possibility and probability. And this guy who wrote it, and I have the book across the room, but I, of course, don't remember the name of it. I think it's called something like Risk Intelligence. He writes about these doctors who do hernia surgery. Apparently, hernia surgery in any given hospital.
Is this Atul Gawande by any chance?
No, it's not. That's a different book.
Okay.
This is about the...
Well, let me just finish that aside, because if you want to read about checklists and risk reward and all that in an environment of surgery, read books by Atul Gawande. He's a brilliant surgeon.
What?
I really like the guy.
I was reading Atul Gawande's book right before I started the risk management book. Maybe I'm mixing them up. Maybe Atul Gawande wrote about that.
Because when you start talking about surgeries, I'm thinking that sounds like Atul.
Okay, so somebody in a book that I read recently wrote about probabilities in hernia surgery. And it clearly made enough of an impact that I remember it, but not enough that I remember who wrote it. So what he said, the mysterious author, unknown, is that in any given hospital, the risk of hernia surgery is something like 15% chance of, like 15% of surgeries come out with complications, or maybe they have to have the same surgery again because there's some issue or there's some problem with the surgery. But there's a hospital in Canada where all they do is hernia surgery, and their risk of problems developing from that surgery, they have it down to 1-2%, which according to hernia doctors is impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Which I find extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
That there's an entire field of experts who think that this is not possible, and then somebody, well, multiple somebodies at this hospital in Canada have disproven it, and the way they've disproven it is by being absolute experts in hernia surgery. That is all they do in that hospital. They don't do any other kind of surgery, and that's all they do over and over all day, as though it's a factory of hernia surgeries. And so they have the same team around them every time, and they all understand each other's movements intimately. And it just makes it work, as opposed to having, you know, like different nurses, different doctors coming in and out, different surgery centers, all kinds of different factors that can cause problems to happen. And I just thought that was fascinating. That we've sort of automated ourselves in a way, like we've automated the human experience in this hospital setting to the point where we've reduced that risk so dramatically.
I think there's something magnificent about this example, because one of the factors that makes it possible to buy a $10 bill for $5 in spite of the fact that everybody says you can't do it is exactly what you're talking about with these doctors in Canada. Is they become extremely specialized in a very small circle of competence.
Exactly. And so, of course, when I read that, sorry to interrupt you, of course, when I read that, I thought of your language of talking about canyons and investing and developing, each of us developing our own expertise in some particular, this is my understanding of a canyon anyway. We haven't really gotten into canyons, so you should explain a little bit more. But my understanding of it is that it's each of us developing our own expertise in a given narrow field, or maybe a couple of given narrow fields, and therefore being able to determine which companies are strong and growing and have right people there and which companies are not, and which industries have systemic risks that you need to know about and which ones don't, like that, those kinds of questions.
Exactly. And the intimidating factor of doing any kind of investing, whether it's real estate that we'll talk about more today, or farms, operations, or picking specific stocks to buy, is that it just seems all so overwhelming, that there's so many things that it appears you might have to know.
As I say constantly.
As you say constantly. And, you know, one of the things that we can learn from just life in general is that, you know, what looks to be overwhelming can be broken down into a series of steps. So for example, if you wanted to travel all the way around the world, that would look pretty overwhelming. But it all starts with just one step, and that one step could be just, you know, a one small walk for an hour westward, and then you stop in a motel and prepare yourself for the next day. And if you break down these huge challenges of trying to understand the whole stock market or how to be a great investor into much, much smaller increments, where all you're really trying to do is understand, let's take real estate, for example, all you really want to try to do is understand the real estate in your area, right? You're not looking in the entire city of Denver. You're looking just in Boulder, and you're narrowing it down to that community of real estate. And further, you're bringing it in even tighter to just the downtown area of Boulder real estate. Yeah. And you could discover, I think, couldn't you, that, I mean, you've just kind of gone through this with your place. You could figure out what those things cost to build. You know, what's the replacement cost for a place like yours? How many are going to get built in the next few years? What's going to drive the market for downtown real estate? Maybe Google coming in with a bunch of jobs. All those things are much easier to get your head around than trying to figure out real estate in America or real estate in Denver, right? Or even real estate in Boulder.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's easier also because living somewhere, I mean, it's easier for me to figure out real estate in downtown Boulder than it is for me to figure out real estate in downtown Denver, because I'm not present in downtown Denver very often, whereas I'm present in downtown Boulder every day. And I can, you know, you gather information just by talking to people, being on the street, reading the newspaper, whatever, like stuff you would normally do, you gather information through. And so it doesn't feel like you're doing this sort of digging exercise, which is what I feel like with the stock market. I feel like I'm sort of digging and not knowing what I'm quite looking for. Maybe it's a sense of perspective. When you're learning about what's going on in your own town, you've got some perspective on it. You kind of know the history a little bit, and you know who to talk to a little bit.
But if you've just moved there, you kind of don't.
And that's why people often say you should live somewhere for a while before you buy anything.
Exactly. Exactly. John Templeton used to say that, who's one of Warren Buffett's favorite guys to point to as a great investor, used to say that the key to his investing success is this idea of scuttlebutt, is what he called it. Just kind of keeping your ear to the ground and knowing what was going on and who to talk to and who to ask questions
that
of.
Old-fashioned term. I imagine so old-fashioned, like a haberdashery. And then...
and a snap brim hat
and like tip their hat to each other and say like, what's the deal, Drew? Okay,
we should bring that back. I want a snap brim hat. I think that would be great. Before I get too old, I want a snap brim hat.
It's a snap brim hat.
That's that kind of hat with the, like, you'd see Humphrey Bogart wear in the movie, you know. It's like snap, the brim turns down in front over your forehead.
Is that
a little
different
bit
than a fedora?
Huh?
That's a fedora, isn't it?
Yeah, like a fedora.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but you bend the brim in a certain kind of way, you know.
In a Bogart-y way.
In a Bogart-y way. I think just would be fun to bring hats back after a while.
I think somebody you should do it.
Oh,
go
gosh.
For it. It's never too late.
I'm the last guy to set a trend. I'm very much a trend, you know, follower. I don't feel comfortable unless it's already out there. That's all I can tell you.
Terrible.
I know. So here's this idea that Templeton used called scuttlebutt. And essentially, Buffett is saying the same thing. And that is that, let me put it in Charlie Munger's words, who said that Warren and I basically, that what makes us so successful is that we have a circle of competence and we know where the boundaries are of that circle and we stay away from that. So we are basically stay away from the boundaries. So we don't get into what could become a gray area, right? And we stay well within our circle of competence. And the way Charlie put it is, look, you know, we know what we know. And here's, you know, lots of people know what they know. But here's the thing that makes us different is we also know what we don't know. And that part eludes a lot of people. They think they know when they actually don't. And so what you're saying about being in downtown Boulder is that after being there for a while, living in downtown Boulder, you start to have friends, you start to have a sense of the community, you start to have some stuff, you have an idea of what you start to know, and an idea of what you don't know after a while. Initially, when you just get there, you don't know what you don't know, you know, because you don't know very much. You so know. I think that's really analogous to being involved in the stock market. And it should be actually not even analogous. It should be the same exact thing, because there shouldn't be any really definable difference between investing in real estate and investing in a farm or investing in a stock. They should be all the same basic formula that we should use as an investment. So that's why I wanted to talk about real estate a little bit here. But we sort of went into the idea of keeping your nose to the ground. And I just wanted to say that while in Boulder, you have to keep your nose around and talk to people and talk to your friends and sort of gather what Templeton called scuttlebutt, when it comes to the stock market, the internet is the world's most massive scuttlebutt factory on the planet. There is so much flying around out there with regard to stock market and specific stocks, rumors, people writing everything about everything. It's actually not a problem of where you're going to get the scuttlebutt. It's how to filter it, how to narrow it down.
Obviously, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone's concerned that they can't find information on the internet.
Well, you know what? I do think...
How reliable is that information?
But I think as you come into stock investing as a novice stock investor, you're worried initially that you don't know anything. And so you don't know... including where to get information, how to figure out how to filter.
Fair point. Yeah, sure. I mean, I would think most people would just Google whatever company they're looking at.
Well, you'd think so, but then what comes up is a bazillion things, right?
Right. That's the point.
So part of what we're going to do here in this podcast as we go out over time is we'll discuss those things that become really important to know. And it turns out there's not that many critical things that you have to know. There's a few critical things, and you need to know those. And you need to know that you know them when you know them. Mm-hmm. And you need to know that you don't know them, or even more important, that you can't know them because of the range of experience you've had with life, because of what you've learned so far. That it turns out many things in the stock market are companies that you really can't know enough.
So you need to have certainty in the parameters of your knowledge.
Beautiful.
And that...
I love the way you said that.
All tasks.
Certainty in the parameters of your knowledge. I love that. I've been saying you need to be an inch wide and a mile deep, but I'm going to change it. By the way, this discussion we had about these surgeries up in Canada, I'm almost certain that comes from Atul Gawande. And the reason I am...
I'm very glad that you've read that book, because I totally would have attributed... this is my problem, is I read too many books at the same time and I get them all mixed up, and then I get excited about the ideas.
It's a good problem
to
have.
How they relate to each other, and then I can't remember which book they came from.
By the way, I will tell you that the one fundamental trait that I know every good investor has, whether they're amateur investors or professionals, is they read a lot. So that quality you have right there, I've enjoyed reading a lot of, from a lot of different sources, not necessarily just business stuff, but just reading a lot about ideas can give you ideas. And so that's good.
Hardly any business stuff.
So, by the way, I got that book from, he has written several, but that one about that Canadian thing I read. Your sister sent me that.
Yeah, it's in, Complications is the one I was reading. So it must have been in that one.
Yeah. So... good on her. So let's dive into this a little bit more in terms of real estate. And what I want to do is bring up an example that was in Fortune magazine. And if you want to look it up, it was in February 24th, 2014, Fortune magazine in a article called Buffett's Annual Letter, What You Can Learn from My Real Estate Investments, which I thought would be apropos to our discussion here. Okay. And I'll basically summarize it here. What he said was...
Wait, that, before you start.
Okay.
Can I just comment?
Sure.
Buffett invests in real estate?
Yes.
Mr. Stock Market? Mr. Amazing Stock Market Investor that we're modeling everything after invests in real estate, which is on our list of things people do that we don't want to do, basically?
Ah, contrary. Real estate is a very, very good asset group. Buffett invests in real estate.
Okay.
He also has invested in silver and gold.
Okay, so we are not actually making a list of things we don't want to do. We're just making a list of other options, and maybe you want to do them sometimes?
I believe we probably do want to do them. Buffett invests in bonds. He does options trading. He's either one of or the largest options trader that I know of. He commonly does multi-million dollar options deals. And he's a very, very good private company investor. So he does private equity. He owns at least 60 private companies that he's bought over the years. And he does public companies. So let's think about this. He's got farms, commodities, gold, silver, bonds, public stocks, and private companies.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
That sounds kind of diversified.
It sounds very diversified. And every one of those investments with a range are investments that he's found that he could buy a $10 bill for $5 or at least a $10 bill for $8, let's say.
Maybe that's how you diversify then. Like you buy stuff across different asset classes, but all stuff that you've specifically chosen, that you're capable of understanding, and that you've bought on sale.
Exactly. Exactly what happens. And even more, I think what happens, Danielle, is that over a lifetime of investing, you'll see that the market cycles, that assets go through different market cycles. And the market cycles for, let's say, stock market might be the opposite of a market cycle for commodities.
Mm-hmm.
It's entirely possible that commodities are going down and the market's going up, and the market goes down, commodities go up.
Isn't that sort of conventional wisdom for why you're supposed to diversify?
It is conventional wisdom for the diversification across asset groups.
Yeah.
And it's not the reason you diversify in the stock market. You diversify in the stock market because of a lack of knowledge in this incredibly boneheaded theory that all things are priced properly at their value. Therefore, you cannot beat the market. And the only way to invest in it, since you don't know one value from another, is to buy a pile of it at once. Whereas
okay.
When you're looking at diversifying across asset groups, you're looking at going for more what we'd call like a rule one portfolio, or what Ray Dalio, who's the fabulous hedge fund investor at Bridgewater, calls and invented the idea called an all-weather portfolio, where you have asset groups that are going to perform differently in different economic environments. So if the economic environment, like think of the economic environment as the weather we're in, in a beautiful sunny day, there are certain activities which are really great to do, right? Maybe having a picnic. On a really big rainy day, you might want to be inside with a fire. So you may not want to be inside with a fire on a beautiful 90-degree day in the summertime. So there's just different activities you want to be doing, different asset groups.
We are learning so much, Dad. Like, we're going from diversification in the stock market is, okay, I'm going to use the term bad because that's simple. And diversification amongst asset groups is good. And that makes sense to me.
And it does make sense. And really, frankly, if you happen to have, you know, $5 or $10 million, probably I know we could set up a rule one portfolio designed to not ever really have any significant loss of capital, and would perform at probably in the 7% to 9% range, almost no matter what would happen. You could have a Weimar Republic inflation, could have a depression, and 30 years later, you're going to come out and it's going to distribute your capital properly. And you've reduced your risk without reducing your return.
this is like totally hitting me in a sort of like informational way. I feel like I've received information. Here's why. You have been saying for months, don't diversify. And I've been just thinking like, what the hell? Why is everybody saying diversify and you're saying not diversify and you're explaining it and okay, fine, it kind of makes sense, whatever, blah, 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 the Failtown method, et cetera, et cetera. But that said, different things happen to different kinds of investments. And I feel very relieved that you're saying that that some diversification in different kinds of groups is a good thing. Okay, I'm being inarticulate. This is making sense to me. This is making me feel better about the entire Rule One plan.
Well, I think if we take it one more step, we're gonna see something really interesting happen, which is that the diversification across these asset groups is organic. It's natural. It's like a forest growing. In other words, if you
now you've lost me again.
Okay, I thought I might. If you're pursuing really good investments, let me back up one step. If you had $10 million, then we would build perhaps this, you know, Ray Dalio all weather slash Rule One portfolio that doesn't lose money. It also doesn't make great high returns. It doesn't do any better than the stock market by itself. What it does is it lowers your volatility so that you're going to do pretty well no matter what happens. Whereas if you're just in the stock market and you have a 1929 stock market crash and a depression, stocks are going to do terribly and you're going to be nearly wiped out. Whereas with this very risk-adjusted diversified portfolio across risk-adjusted asset groups, then you're going to sail through that depression or the Weimar Republic inflation in Germany in the 1920s. You will go through that without significant capital loss. And that's huge to be able to know that you're going to have a portfolio that's passive and you don't have to do anything. The problem is you need $10 million or you need $5 million in order to be able to live on that over a long period of time. What we're talking about is
Wait. You need that much money to choose that kind of portfolio because you want to live off of the returns from that portfolio.
Right.
Is that what you're saying?
Right.
But what if I just want to protect myself and not protect my investments and not live off of the investment returns?
Then absolutely you could, if you're earning enough money over your lifetime to not only keep up with inflation, which will double your cost of living in real terms every 20 years or so. If you're earning enough money and it's growing and keeping up with that, and you can put away enough and it earns enough so that by the time you're ready to stop working or you know, at some point in time you want to have the option to quit working, this can put enough money in the can, then this Rule One portfolio could do the job for you really well. And, you know, you wouldn't have to do anything about learning how to invest other than pick an advisor that can build that portfolio for you. That could well be done. But I'm going to tell you that the amount of money you're going to have to earn and invest is very significant and very hard for most people to do while they're trying to put kids through school, trying to live in a decent neighborhood, you know, trying to have a life. Very tough to get enough money working when you're making returns of 7 or 8% a year. Very, very tough. So this kind of a portfolio isn't designed to give you great returns. What it's designed is to give you okay returns without any huge losses along the way.
So I'm sitting here puzzled because you just said that 8 or 9% returns are not good.
They're not enough for most
people.
And
what we said last time was that an 8% return in real estate is really good.
Ah.
And we're really happy.
Okay, you've caught me in a bit of a contradiction.
Well, I don't know. Maybe that's why real estate is a tougher investment.
But no, let me explain. When we were talking about that, we were talking about sort of an appropriate level of return. And what we didn't really say explicitly, but I'll say it now, is that if you're buying real estate and you're getting something like a 5 or 6% return, which means a 5 or 6 cap rate, mm-hmm. you're buying that at about retail. That's about what it's worth. All right.
Okay.
So, and you remember we said if you're buying a thing with like an 8% return, you're getting a discount to what it's probably worth, all things being equal. If you can buy that same building with $8,000 coming off of it instead of $6,000, the building's actually worth $130,000, not $100,000. And you've now bought it at a margin of safety. Okay? So it wasn't that I was saying that an 8% return is a great overall return in your portfolio. What I was using it for was to determine, to tell you what a cash flow return would look like that would be considered retail by the marketplace. Now, what we want to do in order to get a very high rate of return is to get that $8,000 of cash flow, but I don't want to pay $100,000 for it. I want to pay $50,000 for it. Mm-hmm. And if I can pay $50,000 for it, then first off, my $8,000 is providing a 16% cash flow, which is huge. But even better, I could flip that building in a year or two when a real estate economic environment is better, maybe people can get loans again. I can flip that building for double what I paid for it in, let's say, 3 years. In which case, my rate of return on my cash would be 26% plus the 16% cash flow I got. Then I would think, yeah, I've got a great rate of return. So cash flow coming off of an investment, we assigned it a quality of bad, good, but 8% cash flow coming off an investment, we'd say is pretty good in a real estate investment, but that isn't what we consider to be really good in our overall compounded annual growth rate of our portfolio. We would just consider that to be okay. That'd be average for a typical, stock market portfolio.
Understood. Okay. So what I'm hearing is that 6% is okay. 2%, I think, is the T-bill rate,
yep,
which is our sort of baseline.
Yep, that's our baseline.
6% is okay. 7% is pretty good. 8% is like pretty good. And what you want is 15%, which I cannot say without laughing.
So let's take an example.
Am I right on these numbers?
Yeah, you're right.
Okay.
So let's take an example. So here's an example of Buffett buying a farm that he talked about. He said it's about 50 miles north of Omaha. Now, he didn't buy this farm from a farmer. He bought this farm from the FDIC, which is a federal government agency that now owns this farm 50 miles north of Omaha. And what had happened was that farm prices had skyrocketed as the product prices, commodity prices skyrocketed in the 70s, where we had massive inflation going on. Okay. So inflation typically means that the price of things like corn, gasoline, whatever, the price of real things is going up like a rocket.
Yes.
All right. So that's what was happening in the 70s. Well, if the price of the things coming off of your company, which happens to be a farm, are going up like crazy, probably your farm is going up like crazy. Your company's rising in value. So that's indeed what happened. Farm prices went up and up and up and up and up and up and up. And then the bubble popped. As these market bubbles do, they pop. And when it popped, before it popped, what inevitably happens is everybody decides to become a farmer. And they're buying farms, they're planting to the hedgerows, and they're paying way too much. And of course, they're going to do it with borrowed money. Mm-hmm. And where do they get the money? Well, they get it from the government, which is trying to provide some quality of fairness to the markets by providing an opportunity for farmers to get loans that the banks think are too risky. So the federal government comes in and guarantees a loan.
Okay.
All right. In order to, if this sounds like student loans, it is. And the same thing happens with student loans that happen with farms, is that this guaranteed money creates an environment of lending frenzy, and the price of the thing you're buying goes up. Well, the price of the thing college kids are buying has gone up stupidly high because the money's guaranteed to be there. Well, the same thing happened with farms. It created a bubble. And I hope college professors are listening to this because y'all are in a bubble. and it's going to pop.
I don't know if professors are the ones benefiting from this particular educational rise.
Well, certainly the children at University of Colorado have benefited by having a theme park put into their university last year, which is just off the chart. So any case, that's a whole another subject. Let's just deal with the FDIC guaranteeing this loan to some farmer who extended himself too far. Corn prices come down like a brick. Suddenly the farm can't even pay the cost of farming, much less the loan. And okay. He gets foreclosed on, along with, 20,000 other farms. So now all of a sudden, nobody wants to buy farms. Corn prices are in the toilet. And the banks and the FDIC now have all these farms that they own that they don't want to own. So they start selling them. And when now everybody's selling a farm, the farm prices go down like a brick. Okay?
So this is how Warren Buffett bought a cheap farm.
He bought it cheap. Super cheap. Considerably less than the original loan that the original bank had made on the property. Considerably cheap. So he did a little calculation and he figured out that just based on normalized production on a regular farm out there and based on normalized prices over the long run for corn and soybeans, this farm is going to give him a return of 10%, not 8. Okay? So in other words, he's buying this at a 10 cap rate.
That sounds good.
It sounds good if you consider that it was a 10 cap rate based on just whatever farming practices the FDIC was using.
Oh, you mean it wasn't compared to the actual farmers who cared about what they were doing?
He could do better with a real farmer.
Okay.
All right. So here he gets this thing and has a pretty good deal.
I don't know why
deal.
It backs me up to imagine Warren Buffett like hoeing a field.
I don't think he'd be hoeing. And I think he got into it because one of his son was really interested in farming. So it's like, okay, here's an opportunity.
At least you got somebody.
Yeah. All right. So there's an example of stepping into this operation just like with a business and buying it relatively cheaply given the current production. And expecting that in the long run, corn and soybean prices would go up. And I think actually at that time, corn and soybean prices were like at $2. Corn prices were $2 a bushel. And they've gone up as high as $8 a bushel since then. So you can imagine the profitability of that farm relative to what he paid for it now. All right. Now, let's go over to real estate. Same thing happened to Buffett in New York City, where in the 1980s, a bunch of savings and loans lent a bunch of money to real estate and they overdid it. They lent too much money on subprime real estate and they started to go under. And a government agency called the Resolution Trust Corporation was structured to take over those savings and loans and liquidate their holdings in a kind of a orderly way so that there wasn't a complete collapse. Does this sound familiar, by the way, at all? I mean, sure. Does it sound like we go through these cycles on a regular basis?
I mean, obviously, yeah, of course.
Which is the whole point of Rule 1 investing is that, of course, you can get these deals. Of course, you can buy $10 bills for $5 because we cycle between vast greed and overexuberance to deep fear and really cheap prices. So we just want to wait with cash until we get one of these opportunities. And here's Buffett with cash. The real estate bubble pops in commercial real estate. And the Resolution Trust Corporation has to get rid of these failed savings and loans. And in this particular case, they couldn't unload this property. And guess where it was? It was right next to NYU.
Really?
Yeah, where you went to law school, right? So right next to NYU. Is that a pretty good piece of real estate area for New York?
What year was this?
1980, late 1980s.
Oh, I think it was pretty bad back then.
Oh, yeah. But what is it now?
Well, now it's ridiculous. It's amazing.
Right on. So here's this property in an area where at that time, commercial property was going for about $70 a square foot for rent. Okay? And here's the catch with this property. About 20% of the entire building was rented with one tenant who was paying $5 a square foot and had a 9-year lease.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That's
so
terrible.
And then a big chunk of the rest of the building was empty. So nobody wanted this building because it had a huge piece of it that simply wasn't going to make you any money. You couldn't make any money at all. It cost you more than $5 a square foot just to pay taxes in New York.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah. So what Buffett did is look at this thing and say, well, in the long run, if we hold this building for a long period of time, we're not just going to buy it and flip it. In the long run, what will happen is rents per square foot will go up in general. So they won't stay at 70. They're going to go to 80, 90, whatever. I don't know what they are in Union Square right now, but I bet they're pretty high. And he said, you know, if we can get this thing to cash flow, if we can get it at a price that will give us cash flow, we could buy it today. And in 9 years, we will re-rent it and this value of this building will explode. Right? Totally makes sense.
I mean, he didn't know that Giuliani was going to show up and clean up New York. And he didn't know that that area around Washington Square Park was going to become sort of the gentrified area that it is now. I don't know. I don't know if I buy that in 1980, anybody could have just shown up in the drug-ridden Washington Square Park area and decided that it one day was going to be this incredible yuppie-fied part of New York that, you know, many people deplore.
Well, let me again take Buffett's point of view. He said the first thing was he liked the location because it's next to NYU, and NYU is going to always have a pile of students who need a place. And if those students are there, then there's a place for commercial properties to do the things students need to do. So his first point was that the location, regardless of the condition of the city at that particular time, and by the way, at that particular time, New York was really going through a lot of problems, that was a good location, that it would do well. And so,
I mean, fair point. But that's where price is so important.
That's where price is important.
Because students are not going to make an area become expensive on their own. Students can't afford anything.
But here's the point. He doesn't need it to become expensive.
Right. Yeah, I get what you're saying. So he needs it to match, or he needs it to provide a return based on what he pays, right?
He needs to provide a return based on what he paid. Actually, I think he made that purchase in 1993 for whatever that's worth. And, you know, U.S. was going through a little recession right there and the whole thing. So here's what he needed. He needed to release the building, fill up the empty space, and release that 20% at $70 a foot instead of $5 a foot.
Yeah.
And so that would be the numbers that he's putting into his business plan, not some numbers that, hey, maybe this will be $150 a foot someday, but just that it'll be $70 a foot. And when we release it, that's what we're going to get. Here's what our expenses are. Now, because we know our expenses are X, and we know we're getting 70 a foot for the whole building, we can then figure out what to pay for this building so that it will give us a nice return. Okay? And that's all they do. That's all we do with a regular company. That's all we do with real estate. And that's all we do with farms, is we just try to look at, if this is just standardized at a certain revenue, and I know what my expenses are, then I can figure out what to pay for this thing that will give me a fair price with a margin of safety for, as Charlie says, the vicissitudes of life. And if I can get it for that price because the Resolution Trust Corporation is just dying to get rid of these things, right? It has no vested stake. It just wants to get them off the books at the best price it can, but this has been sitting there for years, and the property is deteriorating, the neighborhood's deteriorating. Let's get somebody in here who will take this and make it better. They're going to dump it for whatever price, and you want to be there when that happens. That's we're doing.
Yeah, well, you want to be there, sure. I mean, like, right, yes, you want to be there when that happens. It's pretty obvious. But the important thing is, sorry. Like, oh yeah, you should buy a building cheaply. Point is, what is cheaply, and how do you know it's cheap? That's the thing that is difficult. That's the thing where you're standing in Washington Square Park going, well, I don't know what's going to happen in the next 20 years. Like, this could become even worse than it is now. And actually, I don't know what it was like in 93. Maybe it was.
Wasn't that bad.
The upswing.
So let me tell you how to figure out what's cheap. We're working on that now, right? You came out earlier on and said, what about 5%? Is that cheap? And we said, well, 6% is, you know, okay. 8% cash flow is pretty good. On the farm, Buffett originally got 10%. On this building, with the rent as it was, okay, with some of the spaces unrented, with 20% of it at $5 a foot in a $70 market, the revenue stream minus the expenses of the building at some price produced a 10% return. So if Buffett could get it at that price that produced a 10% return with those, without those facts about the building, then he would know that 9 years later, when he rents out that 20% at $70 a foot, the value of this building is going to explode. And all he has to do is do the math to see that getting 10% a year and raising rents over time, and then ultimately 9 years later, just the rents go skyrocketing on that 20% of the space, ultimately gives you a phenomenal rate of return. And that's all you really have to do.
Okay.
It's not rocket science.
I'm a little puzzled because I don't see how you can know that New York City real estate is going to.
It doesn't have to go up. It doesn't have to get better. All it has to do.
Not get worse, right?
But it's right next to NYU. How worse could it be? That's all you have to look at, right? How
so you're
much
saying
worse
in this situation, there's some inherent quality of value.
Yes.
That causes it to have sort of a baseline, reasonable, I want to say value again, but that feels like the wrong word. A baseline reasonable price that you would pay?
Because think about it. In real estate, the key things are location, 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 right? So what Buffett's looking at here, and in reference to NYU, being next to NYU, is that children go to NYU. Young adults go to NYU. They have parents. And if this part of New York City becomes overly dangerous and really goes downhill, those parents are not going to let those children go to NYU. Ain't going to happen.
The value of that building is going to crater.
Well, it...
NYU loses students, loses funding.
Right. So basically what Buffett is thinking is that New York City isn't going to let one of the finest universities in the world go down the tubes because they're not willing to police the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Ain't going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's, and that makes sense. And that's what I was asking. So there is, even in real estate, there is this kind of like inherent value to the real estate based on its location.
There is. And in real estate, we look for location, which is what in businesses we call an intrinsic characteristic that gives it durability, right? The location of that building next to NYU is something intrinsic to the building. You can't separate it from that thing. It's locked in, and it's locked in next to NYU, which is ultimately long-term going to mean the neighborhood gentrifies. It has to in the long term. New York City is not going to let it go down the tubes. So the same thing we look for in businesses, which we call a moat, some intrinsic characteristic. You know, a railroad company has railroad track and you can't replace it. You can't get right of ways. So, companies have secrets that you can't get your hands on and they are able to keep going forever because of the secrets. So there's some intrinsic characteristic to a real estate deal, some intrinsic characteristic to a farm deal that makes it a great long-term investment. In the farming operation, it's simple, right? This is the cheapest way to grow crops in the world and the breadbasket of the world right here. And we can feed the world from right here and world population is going to grow from 7 billion to 9 billion, these things are going to get more valuable. So,
okay, so you've convinced me to buy real estate on Washington Square Park in 1993.
Very good.
My question for next time is why shouldn't I just do that instead of buying these stocks?
Very good. You should do that, and you should buy these stocks, and you should buy a farm, and you should buy a private company. You should buy the stuff that Mr. Market is in fear about. Be looking in those markets for the super deals because that's where they are. And then just be sure that you're staying within your circle of competence or staying well within your canyon. So the reason that you might not be buying things in all of these markets all the time is because, you haven't been doing this for 30 years. And the area where you could feel really comfortable about getting up to speed might be relatively limited. So you actually, because you lived right next to Washington Square, you lived right next to Union Square, you might feel pretty confident about coming in there and buying a building. Only trouble is right now, you can't because they're not on sale. All Okay. So we're going to have to look somewhere else. And the beauty of the stock market, to bring it back to stocks, is that real estate cycles are pretty long and slow. Whereas stock market has cycles going on in one of its industries virtually all the time. Right now, oil and gas companies are getting crushed. Coal companies are getting crushed. Commodity companies like BHP Billiton, one of the biggest, best mining companies in the world, crushed. Vale, crushed. Rio Tinto, crushed. Joy Global, crushed. So one after another, these companies, which are fabulous companies, are getting destroyed by a major change in the market. And what you have to do is look in this and say, hey, is this my canyon? Is this my circle of competence? Do I want to, as Charlie said, am I capable of coming up to speed and understanding this business or not? And if I'm not, move to someplace else. There's always another place. That's the beauty of stock investing. And on that note, what should we talk about next time?
I'm like sitting here like nodding my way through this. Okay. So real estate's okay to invest in. This is not where I thought we were going with this. Real estate's okay to invest in. That's what you're saying.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I own some.
It's just that the stock market is so much larger and more diversified and involves so many more places and kinds of industries that you can find more stuff on sale, correct?
Yeah. In fact, it gets so wild that in the stock market, you can buy farms, you can buy land, you can buy hospitals, you can buy buildings in New York City, you can buy companies that make virtually everything. And it makes it, when you start to learn that part of the game and that part of the asset group, you start to find out you can do pretty much any kind of investing you want right there without ever having to travel around in New York and dig your way through a building. So,
That's interesting. That's interesting to me. We've had a lot of discussions about how it's hard to wrap your mind around these, all those commodities companies you just mentioned. I have no idea what you just said because I've never heard of them and I don't care about them. But I can, I'm not saying that I can't learn to care about them, but I don't care about them right now. Whereas you say something about, being able to buy real estate and I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, I get that. And I can relate to it pretty quickly.
Well, how about next time we talk about a company that does real estate and is quite an interesting investment. We can show you kind of that investment parameters around what's known as a real estate investment trust, which is a stock in the stock market of a company that tends to specialize in certain kinds of real estate.
Perfect.
Let's do that next time.
Okay.
Until then, it's time to go play.
Bye, everybody.
See ya. Hey, thanks for listening to Invested, the Rule One podcast. If you like this episode, you can always get our show notes and more details and links to the resources we discussed at investedpodcast.com. Also, as long as you're online, head on over to investedpodcast.com/workshop for details on an upcoming 3-day live workshop that I'm hosting. All you got to do is enter the special podcast code STOCKPILE, that's STOCKPILE, STOCKPILE, into the application form, and you guys can attend for free. So everything discussed on this show is either my opinion or it's Danielle's opinion, and it is not to be taken as investment advice because I am not your investment advisor, nor have I considered your personal situation as your fiduciary. This podcast is for your entertainment and education only, and I really do hope you've enjoyed it. So until next week, it's time to go play. See ya.